coming, but they don't have all the detail and so on.
The Coast Guard says after the boat capsized, the migrants were caught in the Gulf Stream, and today it's expanding its search northward. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Bernard Madoff's sentencing has been postponed until the end of June without explanation. The 70-year-old financier pleaded guilty in March to scheming investors out of $65 billion, said to be the single largest fraud case in history. Madoff could spend the rest of his life in prison. Violent storms plowed through four Midwestern states last night. They contributed to three deaths in northern Missouri, damaged dozens of homes, and cut electricity to thousands of people in several states. The region suffered at least a dozen deadly tornadoes less than a week ago. An update from Wall Street. Dow's now up 50 points at 8336. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Jim Pugh is a well-traveled trombonist now on the jazz faculty at the University of Illinois. He will be my guest on the Thursday edition of Live and Local, along with a young trombonist from Japan, Eijiro Nakagawa, who has made a name for himself in the classical and jazz worlds. We'll hear both players in performance and conversation. It's Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be going to the archives for a program we first broadcast in March. So as you listen, do recall, keep in mind, in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus, we will be bringing you the story of the most famous and probably the largest slave rebellion in the ancient world. It's a story that has fascinated writers and filmmakers and revolutionaries ever since. It took place in the summer of the year 73 BC, beginning as a prison breakout by just 74 men. At the end, this rebel force had grown to 60,000 and controlled the southern part of Italy. The leader was a charismatic former soldier and ex-gladiator named Spartacus. In this hour, our guest is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University, and he's the author of a newly published book titled The Spartacus War. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And Professor Strauss, well, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
One of the points you make here, and just when you get an idea, to get an idea of just how big an event this was, you make the point that based on the total number of slaves we knew that there were in the Roman Empire, that at its height, this rebel army represented 4% of all of the slaves in Rome. And when you think about how many slaves there were, that was a lot. This was a very, very big thing.
Yes, indeed it was.
And perhaps also for people whose only connection with this or all they know about Spartacus is the movie that they've seen, the one that was directed by Stanley Kubrick and featured Kirk Douglas in the title role, they might in fact be surprised that there was actually a real person and that while the actual story might depart a little bit from the film, that the real story is probably just as dramatic, and the people in it are just as compelling as the people are in this movie. So the truth is just as interesting, maybe more interesting than the story that's this most popular version of the story that people maybe will know.
Yeah, I'm glad you think the historical truth is as interesting as the movie, because the movie's very interesting indeed. And people often do say to me, "Well, I didn't know that was a real story." I think that's a really reasonable response, because after all, around the same time as Spartacus, the movie Ben-Hur came out. Ben-Hur is complete fiction, based on an American novel written in the 1800s, whereas Spartacus is based on a true story.
Mm. Well, you talk in the book early on about how the story has many facets, or maybe the way to say it is, as you do, is there are a number of stories here that one can tell. There's a war story. There's a love story. There's a story about identity politics. And we can talk about some of those things. But you also say that really what it all comes back down to ultimately is who this man was. Who was Spartacus and what did he want? So maybe as a way of talking a little bit about that first question, we should talk, or you should talk about, well, who was this man?
Great question. Well, in the movie, they emphasize two things about Spartacus's identity, that he was a slave and that he was a gladiator. And those are both true. But in real life, the slave aspect of his identity was pretty minor. The gladiator, I think, closer to who the man really was. The movie tells us that Spartacus was born a slave and his father and grandfather were all slaves. But in reality, that's not true. Spartacus was a free man. He had been a soldier. He came from a place called Thrace, more or less Bulgaria in today's world. And he had served as an allied soldier in the Roman army. So far from fighting the Romans, he had fought alongside the Romans. Now, something went wrong, and we're not exactly sure what it was. Was he captured by an enemy after a battle? Did he get in trouble with the law and desert? It's just not clear. But whatever the scenario, the guy ends up in the hands of a slave trader who sells him to the Romans, who in turn make him a gladiator. Now, the Romans themselves admitted that this was wrong. This is a violation of Roman law. You can't make someone a gladiator unless he's committed a crime or unless he volunteers to become a gladiator. And Spartacus, whatever he had done, had not committed a crime for which the punishment was being made a gladiator. So Spartacus was a free man with a strong sense of injustice. He'd been humiliated, he'd been dishonored, he'd been mistreated by the very people he had been fighting for. And now he's forced to fight as a gladiator, which is a humiliating thing for a professional soldier. He wants freedom. He wants out. He wants revenge. And he is now in Italy, and he wants to go home. He wants to go back to Thrace. And it looks like what he wants to do when he gets there is he wants to fight the Romans. There is a rebellion going on in Thrace, and it sure looks like Spartacus wanted to become part of it. For him, the slave revolt was a means to an end. He could gather supporters, and he found supporters came to him almost spontaneously once he broke out of the gladiatorial barracks and was in the countryside. But what really made this man tick was his own sense of honor, his love of freedom, his sense of being wronged, and his nationalist desire to do something as a Thracian.
You talked about this time when he was fighting in this auxiliary unit of the Roman army, and I think that's interesting that that's where the word auxiliary comes from.
Indeed,
the Roman army had the regular Roman soldiers, the legionnaires, but also there were units that fought with them that no doubt would have been made up of indigenous people of the places that the Romans conquered. And so, are there some things, if from whatever you know about the Thracians, who they were, and what kind of experience he might have had fighting alongside the Romans, some things that you could say about that, that would he, some knowledge or expertise he would have gained or already would have had that would have contributed to his considerable military success for in so many battles fought against the Romans that at one point he had been serving alongside?
Yes, great question. Well, the Thracians had two cards to play in military terms. They were great horsemen, and they were great guerrilla fighters. They were excellent at raids and ambushes and nighttime attacks and various mountain fighting, various aspects of unconventional warfare, ancient style. The Romans did not have a guerrilla unit in their army, and so it's likely that what Spartacus did in the Roman army is he served as a cavalryman, likely that he served on horseback. The Romans liked to use indigenous peoples in that role because they were never very good at horses themselves. But as a Thracian, Spartacus would have also have known how you fight in the mountains. But in Roman service, I think he probably benefited from the Romans' organizational skills and their administrative experience, and I think that we can say that he brought the best of both worlds to him as a soldier. He knew about unconventional warfare and cavalry fighting. He knew how the Romans organized their infantry and how they organized and fed their army and how they marched. So this would allow him to create his own army, and it would also allow him, give him a leg up over the Romans, because he knew what to expect. He knew how they thought and what they did.
It's also interesting there are a lot of some holes in the story, things where we really don't know for sure what was happening. And one of the things that we really don't know for sure was what exactly were the circumstances around this time from where he, whatever happened, whether he deserted or whatever happened from that point up until the point of his being caught and then ultimately being made a slave and then becoming a gladiator. And you say that the word that they would have used to describe him, the Latin word, is latro.
Yes.
Which you say, interestingly enough, you can translate in a number of ways. That can mean a bandit, but it can also mean an insurgent. Which sort of invites some interesting speculation as to, well, what exactly were the circumstances here at this time? What really was going on? What would have been his reasons? Or did he, in fact, have some sort of turn against the Romans before this point that he was caught and ultimately sentenced to the arena?
Yeah, I mean, we can only speculate, but there's certainly evidence that he deserted in the army and he became a latro, a bandit, an insurgent. Unclear. In Thrace, there was a rebellion against the Romans, and it is possible that Spartacus went from being in the Roman army to defecting and joining that rebellion. Why would he have done that? Well, we don't know. Some have speculated that he was disgusted by the misbehavior of the Romans in repressing this rebellion, and we know the Romans were very brutal. Others have said, well, that's possible, but maybe he had some personal quarrel. Maybe he had a grudge with someone that led him to this way of life. Just can't be sure.
Let me just quickly introduce once again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. Barry Strauss is professor of history and classics at Cornell University. He has written or edited several books, most recently The Trojan War, A New History, and the one that we're talking about here this morning. The title is The Spartacus War, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, which tells a story of this slave rebellion in the year 73 BC led by Spartacus, who, as we said at the beginning of the program, was a real person. Many people might know it from the movie, but in fact, he was a real person. It was a real uprising, and it was a very significant event in the history of the ancient world, and this book tells the story. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, he was sent to a gladiatorial school in Capua. That's in southern Italy. I guess it's not all that far from Naples.
Right.
What was Capua like in those days?
Well, at the time, Capua was the second biggest city in Italy, second only to Rome. So it was a large place, and it was known as a trading center, a manufacturing center. Many goods came in from the east. It was famous for its perfumes and its roses and its metalwork. And it was a huge center of slavery, very important Italian slave market. And in fact, it might have been the one city in Italy where ex-slaves, freedmen, had a measure of political power. Capua had once been a rival to Rome for supremacy in Italy, and the Romans had decisively defeated it and made sure that Capua would never rise to that status again. So in a way, the Romans were happy to have ex-slaves in power in the town, because from their point of view, it demeaned the town's status.
So it seems like, though, if you were going to have a natural place for a slave rebellion to start, that would be the place.
Yes, in many ways. I think that one of the things that would have occurred to the gladiators is they would have noticed that there were slaves in town who made it to freedom. And it might have occurred to them, gosh, if those folks can rise up the ladder, why can't we? Why do we have to wait here and risk our lives as gladiators?
What would we know about what life would be like in a gladiatorial school at this time?
We know quite a lot about what gladiators' lives were like. The Romans were fascinated with gladiators. They were both the sports heroes of the Roman world, and they were bad boys. Many of them were criminals, foreign soldiers, and some of them had volunteered to actually become gladiators because there was a certain glamour to the gladiatorial life. From our point of view, gladiators led a very harsh, regimented life in a very risky profession. But from the Romans' point of view, it wasn't all that bad. When we consider how many people in Roman Italy were slaves and how harsh the conditions of slavery were, then we have to look on gladiators as privileged slaves who were very well fed, who got expert medical care, who received training in a profession, and who received the adulation of the crowds, and if they actually survived, could end up retiring rather well off.
Mm. So these stories that we have seen in movies about that very thing, about gladiators that became celebrities, became very popular, managed through a number of fights to survive, could indeed retire and end up living a good life after the arena.
Yes, they're true. As long as we remember that, as is usual with great success stories, the vast majority of people never enjoyed that success.
Mm. So what do we know about the breakout that resulted from the escape here from the school? What can be said about what happened?
Well, as in the movie, we know that the breakout actually began in the kitchen of this gladiatorial institution. Originally, there was a conspiracy of 200 gladiators. Perhaps that was most of them in the school. We don't know exactly how big the school was, but it was discovered, and most of them were suppressed. Only 74 were able to escape in the end. They didn't have any weapons because the weapons were locked up, so what they used was just what they had at hand, knives and skewers. And just using knives and skewers, they overpowered the guards, and they escaped.
It seems like you would, if you were a guard in a place like this, or you're running a place like this, you would know that the people that you had there were dangerous.
Yep.
They were capable of fighting and killing. They maybe didn't really want to be there. They maybe would, despite the fact that some people do, some people actually survive the experience. They might have to know, they might have to think, well, we really have nothing to lose here. You would think that you would be a little bit more careful, that security would be much more important, and that something you'd make sure that something like this just couldn't happen.
Well, they were careful in that they locked up the weapons.
Mm.
These guys had no weapons. The guards were armed, and the gladiators had no weapons. And I think the guards just couldn't conceive of it that if the gladiators came at them with kitchen knives and skewers, that they would be able to defeat them.
Mm.
That was the failure of imagination. I think the other thing they had going for them is that the Romans, like all ancient peoples who had slaves, made a real point of mixing the different ethnic groups of slaves. So Spartacus was a Thracian, therefore the school was not made up completely of Thracians. There would be Thracians, and there were Celts, and there were Germans. Those are the three main groups. And I suppose the guards thought it's very unlikely that they will form common cause, that they will make a common cause, but they did. That's precisely what they did.
And
the other thing that I think they hadn't counted on.
Well, that, and I suppose that invites the question, was that something that contributed to the success of the rebellion, the fact that people that came from different ethnic backgrounds or different nationalities, they decided that, any sort of differences that they had or feelings that they were distinct peoples, they would put that aside in the interest of this more common goal of fighting the common enemy.
Yes, to the extent that the three main ethnic groups were able to do that, to the extent that they were able to form, make a common cause, it contributed to their success. Unfortunately, they weren't able to do it in the long run, and they did end up breaking apart on these different ethnic lines. But while they were able to join together, it really made a formidable force.
Yeah. That does suggest that was maybe the long-term problem, the long-term downfall, was that there was Spartacus, and then there were a number of people that were his immediate commanders who no doubt had command over an allegiance of certain numbers of people, and that everybody seemed like there were some different agendas. Some people really maybe had this idea that they would indeed be able to fight their way back to where they had come from. And maybe other people said, well, you know, we're not going to do that. We might as well just do what we can here and really resorted to banditry, what was clearly, without a doubt, banditry terrorizing and pillaging the countryside.
Right.
So it was sort of a complicated set of motives. If we, you know, ask the question, well, were these good guys or bad guys? The answer to that turns out to be kind of complicated.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, the advantage of makeshift ragtag armies is that they have enormous energy. And the disadvantage is that they lack organization, they lack institutions, they lack discipline. And that came true in spades with Spartacus's army.
Well, what though does that the fact that they were as successful as they were, that must say something about his leadership, particularly, and his ability to the extent that he could and did to of holding this all together, at least for a couple of years, and that was pretty significant.
Yeah, our main source, our main Roman source about Spartacus, someone who was alive at the times, you know, praises Spartacus as a man of outstanding strength and intelligence, physical strength and you know, mental intelligence. And I think that really holds true. Again and again, we can see that Spartacus's plans and his grasp of military tactics made all the difference.
We are just about at our midpoint here. Let me just very quickly again say our guest is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University, and we're talking about his most recent book. The title is The Spartacus War. It's published by Simon & Schuster and tells the story of the slave rebellion against the Roman Empire that was led by Spartacus, happened in the year 73 BC. And if you're interested in reading the story, it's a good story. You can take a look at the book. And questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I mentioned a little bit earlier about how in the introduction to the book, you say really the story, there are a number of stories here. There's the war story. There's also a love story. And you talk here in the book about the woman who played a key role here, who was his partner. We don't know her name. What do we know about this woman?
Well, we know, first of all, that she existed. People who remember the movie will recall that Kirk Douglas's love interest was played by Jean Simmons. She was a slave who they call Varinia. That name is fiction, but the real Spartacus really did have a love interest. Like Spartacus, she was a Thracian, and she came from the same tribe of the Thracians as Spartacus. Alas, we don't know which tribe that was. One thing the movie doesn't say is that this woman was an important religious figure. She worshipped the god Dionysus, and she was a prophetess. She went into trances in worshipping Dionysus, and in the trances she had visions, and she issued prophecies about Spartacus, saying that he was chosen by the god, and he would go on to do great and fearsome deeds. She talked about a scene that presumably is imaginary, that when Spartacus was sold into slavery, he was sleeping, and a snake came and wrapped itself around Spartacus's head. Now, herpetologists tell me that snakes don't do things like that, so this would have been seen as a miracle. The snake was the symbol of Dionysus. Dionysus was an absolutely protean god in the ancient world, worshipped in many places. He was the national god of Thrace, but he also was the god of wine, as you know, and the god of liberation. And in Italy in particular, poor people, oppressed people, slaves, looked to Dionysus as their hopeful sign of liberation and freedom. So Spartacus, the Thracian woman, his love interest, was also his priestess, his prophetess, who preached the gospel according to Spartacus, a kind of liberation theology.
And having the ostensibly having the favor of Dionysus, this was helpful for this whole enterprise?
I think so. It was a way of advertising the enterprise. It was a way of adding to the Spartacus already had celebrity as a gladiator, and he had a certain kind of street cred. This adds religious charisma to it. You know, I think we can think of insurgent movements more recently in which religion plays an important organizing role. And I think that for Spartacus as well, religion was a way of attracting adherents, a way of stirring up the faithful to support him and to take a chance on this rebellion.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think initially when I read this about the fact that Dionysus was sort of the patron of this movement, and I think initially, I guess I didn't really realize the complexity of Dionysus. Initially, I thought, well, gee, that's sort of an odd pick. I'm thinking, well, heck, why not pick Mars?
Right.
Why pick Dionysus? But now it becomes sort of more interesting and more understandable when you talk about the different aspects of Dionysus and how people thought about him, and particularly the idea that he was somebody that would appeal to the downtrodden.
Yes.
Well, we have a caller here to bring in to the conversation. Let's do that.
Great.
In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Can you tell me something about the historical sources, the contemporary sources that there were, about how many and what the main ones were?
Sure. There are several Roman historians who write about Spartacus, who were alive at the time of the revolt. The one who provides the most details is a man named Sallust. Sallust was a protege of Julius Caesar. He wrote a number of important works. One of them was a general history of the early part of the first century B.C. And parts of that history survive, and parts of them describe Spartacus's revolt. Second source is a man named Varro, better known as an agricultural writer. Varro only gives us one piece of information about Spartacus, but it's a very important piece of information. He tells us that Spartacus was compelled to be a gladiator even though he was innocent. Third source of information is Cicero. Cicero refers to Spartacus in a number of his speeches, provides various details of the revolt, in particular about Spartacus's attempt to cross over to Sicily. And the fourth one is Julius Caesar. In his famous commentaries on the Gallic War, on the conquest of Gaul, Caesar talks about the role that Celts and Germans had played in Spartacus's slave revolt and talks about what it's like to fight Celts and Germans based on that. Now, there are a number of other important sources who did not live at the time. They lived later, ancient sources, but they had access to other books about the time. The two most important of them are Plutarch, famous Plutarch's Lives, and then a writer who's not as well known, a man named Appian of Alexandria, who wrote extensively about Roman history. So those are our main sources.
Right. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, after the breakout, the uprising at the gladiatorial school there in Capua, there was a major – Capua is on a major road that runs – I guess there are two roads. There's the Appian Way that goes east, and there's the Via Annia that goes south.
Right.
So they head on the road south, and they go to – and it's not all – I guess not all that far. They go to Vesuvius,
yes.
Mount Vesuvius,
yes.
Which people, of course, right away will think of the eruption and of the destruction of Pompeii. And
yes.
This was actually – that was sometime in the future. That
yep.
was like 150 – it would be 150
yep.
years before
yep.
that happens.
Yep.
So at the time, Vesuvius was not exploding. It hadn't exploded for a long time.
No.
So they head for Vesuvius, and there they make their kind of camp. They make their stand on top of the mountain. Was there some particular reason? Was that good from a strategic point of view?
Yeah, it was excellent from a strategic point of view. It was a natural fortress. It played to Spartacus's strengths as a Thracian because he knows how to fight on mountains. And it's also a very, very wealthy area. Vesuvius, volcanic soil, very fertile. It's ringed with some of the wealthiest estates and wealthiest farms in the Roman world. It's thickly wooded, so it's got game. You can hunt them to live on, and you can hide in the forest. And you can raid at will, going after these farms and looting all the wealthy places there. So Vesuvius is a great base.
Hmm. Back in Rome, no doubt they thought, well, okay, we got to do something about this. We just can't let this go.
Right.
So they picked someone who should have been, by the virtue of his position, a fairly highly placed individual, someone about who we really don't know very much, except that they sent him down there and Spartacus and his guys handed the man his head.
Right.
This man named Caius Claudius Glauber.
Yes.
Here again, this is a really great story. Apparently the Romans arrived and they thought, well, okay, we have these guys trapped.
Yep.
They can't get out. Tell the story of this first battle between Spartacus and his men and the Romans.
Well, there's only one road down from the top of Vesuvius, and the Romans block it. And they think that's that, you know, we can just starve him out. But they underestimated Spartacus, because what Spartacus does is he has his men, and there'd be women in this army too, he has them weave ropes out of vines. Vesuvius is covered with wild grapevines, and you can actually make ropes out of them. I had a scientist in Naples try an experiment with some farmers there, and they easily weaved ropes. They may not be strong enough for rappelling down the mountain or rappelling very far, but you can use them as handholds. And Spartacus and the rebels did just that. Using these ropes, they managed to sneak down around the Romans, so they didn't have to use the road, and the Romans didn't see them come down. The Romans didn't have their guard up, and their camp wasn't nearly as well guarded as it should have been, because they didn't think they were in any danger. And suddenly, Spartacus and his men were there attacking, and they defeated the Romans and took over the camp and sent them packing. So this was really a great victory.
And is it known what happened to the man who was the commander? Was he killed?
We don't know. Hmm. Probably not killed, because that's the sort of detail that would have survived. Probably just disgraced.
It would have been the end of his political career in Rome.
Well, very likely. There were people who came back from defeats, but this would not have been a good calling card on the way to success. Hmm.
So how was the news of this Roman defeat at the hands of Spartacus and his followers, how was that received in Rome?
Well, we don't know, but we can imagine. We know that the Romans took this revolt seriously, and they sent out reinforcements. And yet, by the same time, the Romans tended to look down on runaway slaves, tended to think they were naturally inferior. They tended to have a certain amount of contempt for gladiators. And I would imagine that they thought that it was really only a matter of time before Roman discipline prevailed and they were able to put this guy in his place.
And then, this sort of gets to be a complicated story, and we have all kinds of Latin names over the next period. But here, the Romans sent army after army, group after group of big groups of soldiers, led in some cases by the consuls, who would have been the top officials, the top public officials of the time. And you would think that increasingly, as it became apparent just how formidable the foe this was, that they'd try to pick the people who they thought would be the most able and set the best soldiers against them that they could. And until the very end, when he was defeated, Spartacus and his followers managed to defeat commander after commander. What was it that made it possible for him to be so successful against what at the time would have to have been the world's best army?
Well, two things, really, and he was immensely successful. First, there's Spartacus' own skill. He is a very skilled general. And we don't know, but it wouldn't be surprising if some of the other soldiers in this army also had military experience before they became slaves, and so were able to teach a thing or two to the new recruits. The second thing, though, is that the Romans were not sending out the A-team against Spartacus and the rebels. It's because the A-team or A-teams were already abroad. The Romans had a number of fights on their hand in this period. They were putting down a rebellion led by a renegade Roman general in Spain. They were fighting a rebellion in Thrace, as I already mentioned, and that Thracian rebellion was an offshoot of a major rebellion that was located in what is today Turkey. And finally, they were dealing with the threat of pirates in the eastern Mediterranean, especially around Crete. The Romans already had tens and tens of thousands of men under arms abroad, and their best generals were sent abroad. And they had to scrape the bottom of the military manpower barrel in order to come up with armies at home. And they felt they gambled on the fact that they thought that Spartacus, as annoying as he was ultimately a less dangerous enemy than the enemies they were fighting in Spain and in the East. So that was their gamble. They didn't count on Spartacus doing quite as well as he did and on causing them as much of a problem as he did. So that they couldn't, in the end, wait for those armies to come back from abroad. They had to come up with a new army in Italy to fight Spartacus. Mm.
Well, how much ultimately, how much territory would you say that Spartacus controlled?
Well, you know, he controlled large swaths of southern Italy. If you think of the Italian boot, and you think of the heel and the toe and the sole, the foot of the boot, if you will, that was under Spartacus's control, reaching up beyond the ankle. So a large part of the calf as well was under Spartacus's control. A lot of southern Italy was Spartacus' country, and he did also march north into Italy, almost all the way to the Alps. And although he did not stay in the north, he won victories in the north, and he won recruits to his cause in the north. So he did a lot of damage to Roman Italy.
And I suppose that also invites the question, well, at that point, why didn't he just march out of Italy and go home to Thrace or someplace else?
Yeah, that's the big question. Spartacus wanted to do that. That was his goal. He could see the writing on the wall, and he knew that the A-team would be coming back sooner rather than later. The problem was he could not sell his men on this plan. They didn't want to leave Italy for a variety of reasons. First, anyone looking at the Alps would think twice before agreeing to cross them. Secondly, some of his men had been born in Italy. Italy was the only home they knew, and they weren't all that eager to go back to a homeland they'd heard their parents talk about. And third, success spoiled them. They were winning against the Romans. Italy was probably the wealthiest part of the ancient Mediterranean world in this period, and this slave army was cleaning up. And so a number of the men would have said, why should we leave now when we're winning? Let's keep on looting this place, and only when we're done squeezing it, then we'll be ready to leave. So Spartacus lost that battle.
Hmm. So there was apparently at some point this idea, or he had this idea, that he would escape Italy and go to Sicily.
Yes.
And made some kind of agreement. Ultimately, it didn't happen, but with pirates in Sicily to get them across that the Strait of Messina from
yes.
Italy, from the toe
yes.
Into Sicily. Do we know exactly what happened there?
No, we don't know exactly what happened. We know that Spartacus made a deal with the pirates to ferry him and his men across, and the pirates took a hefty deposit, and then they skedaddled. They left Spartacus high and dry. Now, did they do this just because they were pirates and pirates cheat people, or did they do it because they were pressured by the Romans and afraid of the Romans? We don't know. We do know that the Romans were well aware of the threat of Spartacus crossing to Sicily, and so they fortified the Sicilian shores. So this wouldn't have been an easy thing for the pirates to do.
Well, you just can't trust pirates.
No, you can't trust pirates.
Barry Strauss is our guest. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University. He has written or edited several books, one on the Trojan War, which we discussed on this program. And if you'd like to hear that, you can go to our web archive. His newest is The Spartacus War. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It tells the story of the slave rebellion led by Spartacus against Rome in 73 BC. It's a good story. So if you're interested, you can look for the book. Questions are welcome to 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So how did the Romans finally accomplish the defeat of Spartacus?
Well, they did it led by a man named Marcus Licinius Crassus. That's Laurence Olivier, if you remember the movie. Mm-hmm. Crassus had a reputation as the richest man in Rome. He was not beloved of the Senate and the faction that ran the Senate. He was more of a popular figure. And the Senate only agreed to turn command over to him when everyone else had failed and things were going quite badly for the Romans. Crassus, very experienced general, and he was able to convince some veterans to come out of retirement to join the army. It's possible that he used some of his personal fortune to finance at least part of the army. We don't know that. In any case, the Romans under Crassus come up with a vast army. It's as big an army as Caesar uses to conquer Gaul. And Crassus was a brutal disciplinarian. His goal was to make the Romans more afraid of him than they were of Spartacus. And he does this by executing men who ran away from the battlefield, using a process of decimation, whereby the Romans would kill every tenth man in a unit that had misbehaved. That, for all those reasons, he is effective in building a Roman army that's big enough and tough enough to threaten Spartacus. And it's this army that ultimately defeats Spartacus. But it's not a quick or easy thing. They're not ready to fight Spartacus right away. Spartacus almost escapes to Sicily. Then they block Spartacus in the toe of the Italian boot behind a vast fortifications work. But Spartacus manages to break through. And what really wins it for Crassus is that after these failures and his men are exhausted, they split into two separate groups. A lot of his army breaks away, and the Romans are able to take on and defeat the breakaway group first, and only then to turn on a much diminished army under Spartacus and force them to a showdown on the battlefield. And the Romans win that showdown. Spartacus dies fighting. Various accounts of how he died bravely. His body's never found. The army is crushed. Survivors flee into the hills, but a lot of them are captured, and 6,000 of them are crucified on the main highway between Capua and Rome.
So that detail, which people, again, may remember from the movie, that actually was true. Spartacus was not, he was killed in the battle, so he
Correct.
Was not one of them.
Correct.
That's one place where the story of the movie departs from the truth. But this other business where they crucified these people and put them along the roadway all the way from one end to the other, and they left them there apparently for a couple of years, that all was true.
Yes. I don't know if they left them for years, but for a long period of time in any case. That's all true. Very gruesome, but absolutely true.
Was this good for the image and the political career of Crassus?
It was. Sad to say, this sort of grotesque punishment did actually help Crassus. It gave him a reputation as the man who restored Italy, order to Italy, and who ended the slave revolt, who saved the stability of Roman society. In Roman eyes, it was not as good as defeating a foreign foe. That would have given him greater prestige. But it was good enough, and it propels Crassus to the top of Roman politics.
We have a couple of callers. We will try to get them in the time that remains. We have maybe about 5 minutes. We'll go first to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Well, it seems to me that for Spartacus, this was perhaps the least opportune time to revolt against the Roman Empire at its early stage when it was quite strong, that if it had happened a couple of hundred years later, he might have been more successful.
You mean if he had...
If a revolt had come a couple of hundred years later, obviously not under Spartacus, mm-hmm. that leader would have had a easier time than Spartacus had at the height of the Roman Empire.
I agree. For Spartacus or anyone to think that he could mold a group of slaves into an army capable of defeating the Romans in Italy in this period of history, I think that's just unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
But Spartacus didn't think that. He thought that his only real hope was to escape. And yes, if this revolt had come during the late Roman Empire when Rome was weaker, then it would have had a much better chance of success. So I agree with that comment. I think that's an astute observation.
Very interesting. I'll have to read your book.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to Greenup, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I very much enjoy your program. I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Thank you.
I'm an ethnobotanist who has worked in the Mediterranean in various areas from Turkey to Egypt to Greece to Rome,
great,
to Italy and Spain, Portugal. And one thing I just wanted to mention, that's certainly good information about using grapevines to make rope to come down Vesuvius. There are some other plants also that are very good rope products.
Really?
Members of the cotton family, the Malvaceae family,
mm-hmm,
that grow as weeds there that make a really strong rope, one of the strongest ropes ever.
And would they grow in Italy?
Yes. They're growing, yeah, they're a weed in the fields there.
Fantastic.
Native there. And also a number of other vines that could be used for rope and the bark of various trees, and that can be done really quickly.
That's great. That's really interesting. Thanks.
Very interesting program.
All right. Well, again, thank you. Let's go on. We'll talk next with someone in Effingham, and this would be our line number 2. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I just can't think of the parallels between those times and present times and the dominance of paternal ideas and the way we live and the horrendous facts of the last 8 years and our own local Roman emperor. That's just my observation, but I just can't help but see the horrors since maternalism was done away with. And thanks again.
Well, and I think that Professor Strauss, I think one of the things that got you interested in exploring this story further, in addition to just wanting to know more about who this man really was you also were thinking about insurgencies today and insurgencies then, and maybe thinking about, are there some kind of parallels you can draw?
Yes, it's very hard to look at this subject without constantly thinking of our current situation, and that it's a reminder that history is cyclical, that it repeats itself, not exactly in the same way, but that there are some patterns and similarities that come back again and again.
Mm. Something that I think is also really interesting is that not only has this story captured the imagination of writers, so it ends up appearing in a lot of books, and of course there is the most famous, the one that probably most people will know, is the film,
mm-hmm,
the one was directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
But for a lot of real life revolutionaries, Spartacus has been over the years has been an important touchstone.
Yes, certainly. Karl Marx was a great admirer of Spartacus. So was Lenin and Stalin. In Germany in 1919, there was a workers' uprising that called itself the Spartacist Revolt. Spartacus played a big role in Soviet ideology, and even still today, there are sports clubs called Spartacus clubs all over Eastern Europe.
Let's take another caller here. We have someone in Champaign. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Could you put the Spartacus Rebellion in context with the Italian ally sort of civil war they had?
Excellent question. Yes, there had been a civil war in Italy, but only a generation before Spartacus's revolt, and that war had been suppressed rather brutally. In the end, the Romans were forced to accept the Italians as full-fledged citizens, although many in the Roman elite were rather grudging about that. There's been a lot of speculation as to whether Spartacus didn't get some of his supporters from those disgruntled allies, and whether there was smoldering resentment that didn't help Spartacus. All we can say is we can only speculate. We know that there were some free, poor farmers, very poor farmers, who joined the slave rebellion. And we have the name of one southern Italian ally who supported Spartacus. That, unfortunately, is all the evidence we have. There may be more to it than that. On the other hand, free people of middle class and upper class status in the ancient world were generally very reluctant to get involved in a slave revolt. Class trumped nationality on that level. So there may have been some support from the former rebels against Rome, but in the evidence we have, alas, we really can't be sure of it.
So just, I suppose it just as a way of closing, it's a way of, it may be significant to think about just what the significance of a slave revolt would be and just how significant a challenge to the prevailing social order such a thing would be.
It's a good question. I think that it's reasonable to start with American history and to think just what dynamite slave revolts in the Old South were. You know, if you think of Nat Turner's rebellion, which was just a few hundred men, or you think of John Brown, which again was a very small number of men, and then you multiply the numbers to be tens of thousands or even more, given the population in the South, that's an earthquake in the social order, and particularly when the revolt is starting 125 miles away from the capital city. Mm. It's very, very threatening to those in the powers that be.
Well, we're going to have to stop. It's a good story. People want to read it. Look for the book that we've talked about. It's The Spartacus War, published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell. Professor Strauss, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. The show was first broadcast on March 18th. Many past programs from Focus 580, from the Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production is available on that website, and it's ready for you to listen whenever you're ready. If you haven't taken a look at it, do that. It's at will.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything that you need to know about taking advantage of the programming that's there. Well, just a quick mention also that tomorrow morning on the program, in hour number one, we will talk with a man who has been called the evangelist of entrepreneurialism. His name is Carl Schramm, and he is the president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation. He also will be in Champaign-Urbana this weekend to be one of the featured speakers at the commencement ceremonies that will be going on Sunday. And he'll be talking with us tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour by telephone about entrepreneurship. It's something that he says that Americans really fail to appreciate that the entrepreneurial impulse is the most powerful thing that we have. And if we are going to maintain our economic status, that's the thing that's going to make it possible. So we'll try to talk a little bit about that, what that means for the way we approach business, what it means for the way that universities run, and what that means for individuals and how we live our lives. That'll be hour number one. Hour number two, we'll be talking about infrastructure. And here, literally, of course, we're talking about things like roads and bridges and all the sorts of things that we really depend on, the structure of our lives and our societies, and something that many people argue has been neglected. And there's a really serious need to make sure that it is maintained and improved. And we'll be talking with Arnab Chakraborty. He is Associate Professor of Urban and Regional Planning here at the University of Illinois. We'll talk about issues here in Illinois and beyond. That's tomorrow in hour number two. Support for the program today comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium at 203 North Vine in Urbana. With wines, beers, spirits for the series collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll rebroadcast an interview with historian Susan Wise Bauer, author of The Art of the Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America. That will follow the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, July wheat is trading at $6.41.5. That is up 3.5. September, $6.51, up 3. In Chicago, May wheat, $5.81.5, up 2.75. July, $5.92.25, up 3.5. half. May corn, 420 and a half, up 1. July, 426 and a quarter, down 1 quarter. September, 435 and a half, unchanged. December, 447 and a half, up 1 quarter. May soybeans, 1164 and 3 quarters, up 14 and 3 quarters. July, 1141 and a quarter, up 13 and a quarter. August, 1095 and a half, up 10 and a half. September, 1036 and 3 quarters, up 9 and 3 quarters. November, 989 and a quarter, up 7 and 3 quarters. May meal, 383 even, up 450. May oil, 38.73, down 17. Under the livestock contracts, June live cattle, 82.75, up 25. August, 82.70, down 12.5. May